also one of the major movies that needs to be considered in this ongoing series of what great people think about great movies, particularly with respect to a science fiction scenario, is The Joy of Metropolis. Metropolis, of course, 1927, originally released by a German studio which was almost bankrupted by it. It's gone down in legendary status. It's been revamped in so many ways over the years. But we're delighted now to share some thoughts about the movie and Metropolis, etc., with the legend from The X-Files, from graphic narratives around the globe, from, of course, Chilpack Hollywood, comedian, improvising artist extraordinaire. It's the one and only Dean Haglund. Dean, how are you, sir?
Thank you, Alex. I'm great, and thank you for having me.
A genuine delight. Let's Fritz Lang, and I always thought Metropolis 1926. Actually, it's 1927. Lots of incarnations in terms of the piece itself. But from your own point of view, I mean, we were both born after Metropolis. Let's make that quite clear before the first time round.
yes.
So we won't be around for this. Well, we'll probably be around for the centenary. But right. in terms of the movie itself, I mean, some critics have said it's got everything in there. It's got German expressionism. It's got the robots. It's got science fiction. It's got proto-fascism. It's got everything. What are the kind of key things from your own perspective?
Well, a lot of things, actually. I think in terms of camera work and art direction, think of the not just the stars like Fritz Lang and the actors, but the cinematographer Karl Freund, who came out and later did Dracula, 1931 Dracula with Bela Lugosi, and went on to get out of retirement to develop the three-camera sitcom shoot for I Love Lucy. Like, that's how long the lineage goes from Metropolis all the way into Hollywood.
And the actual narrative itself, certainly, I mean, initially most folk would probably turn around and say, well, silent movies, did they have? Of course they had narratives. I mean, silent movies had been going. I mean, we'd had the first blockbuster with Birth of a Nation with D.W. Griffith a decade beforehand. But this thing, though, which it's not that movies and science fiction were not bed buddies, because clearly there were intentions of actually working through this as the whole scenario. But was it really, was Fritz Lang the Steven Spielberg of his day in Weimar Germany? Because we hear that he was the only person to effectively have the clout to make this movie.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, he was an exacting director. Apparently the scene where Joseph falls at the feet of Maria, just that one scene alone took 2 weeks to shoot. And as you said, went over budget by five times its original budget, nearly bankrupting the studio. So he was exacting. He had also directed M, the other silent classic film. And I think you have these exacting standards, and he came from a time in the 20s where there was a lot of creative arts going on in Germany that was funded by the government. You think of Bertolt Brecht, the theater director, who could rehearse a play for 6 to 8 months, not even knowing what the story was. And I think this kind of creative process that a lot of the German directors came out of, long, exacting process of directing through theater, worked its way into film.
We'll be going on to talk about the legacy, of course, of Metropolis, and you can include things from 2001 A Space Odyssey to Cloud Atlas, really, being part of that whole sequence from that point of view.
Absolutely. Think of this, the first time you ever saw an android. Like a robot in science fiction.
Well, in terms of robots, you clearly building on what Carol Čapek had put forward with Rossum's Universal Robots in 1923 and the play that went out there. But you're absolutely right in terms of an android, an artificial life form shaped like a human, and also shaped like an attractive human, because Maria was obviously the key aspect in terms of gender that was really developed for that.
Absolutely, and you see the sculpting work that was done by a famous German sculptor. I'm trying to remember his name, actually. I'm sure it's off the top of my head. But he modeled it on her body so that when the two would meld together, it would be seamless.
One of the aspects we'd actually seen mentioned was that, we obviously talk about Fritz Lang, let's not forget his wife, Thea von Harbau, because she, I think, had a key thing to work with in the movie. She also wrote a novelization of the film, which is quite different. So it's like Blade Runner and Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, really.
Absolutely.
But and I use that deliberately because I think that the Tower of Babel that we see in Metropolis with Alfred Abel as Friedison, played by Alfred Abel as the master of Metropolis, very much echoes the Tyrell Corporation. And I think, you know...
Absolutely. And not only that, Fritz Lang said when he went to New York in 1924 and he saw the massive skyscrapers of the time, that was his inspiration for the visual look of Metropolis. And you see the, you know, multi-leveled elevated roadways and flying machines going through the air. And then you look then towards Blade Runner, how the opening scene, again, is a massive amount of skyscrapers and multi-leveled pathways of flying vehicles. It's a direct lineage in terms of art direction, for sure.
One critic, which I thought was quite fascinated by the whole issue related to Metropolis, regarded the movie itself as being, whether consciously or not, Lang and von Harbau threw almost everything that excited them into the pot. Skyscraping cityscape of New York, tick. The dying embers of German expressionism, yes, tick. The bold new geometries of Art Deco. The competing influences of communism and fascism in Weimar Germany. Christian eschatology, robotics, romanticism, and the ideas of Sigmund Freud. What's not to love?
Yes, what's not to love? And combining that all together. And Thea, I understood, wrote the novel specifically to be put into a screenplay form and into the film form. So the novel was a way of working out these ideas in a narrative structure, which even Fritz Lang said later in some interviews that he thought the plot itself was a bit silly, but that so many of the ideas that came out of it a lot of the other elements in terms of sci-fi and art direction, as we said, were influential. But the plot itself is actually somewhat convoluted if you try actually explain it. I mean, it goes in multiple directions. You have a whole bunch of scenes in the Japanese bar of sin, the den of sin, the Yoshinawa. And a lot of that was edited out, which is why it took so long to find prints in Argentina and New Zealand to actually reassemble a movie as it was originally delivered in 1927.
And that is the key point, of course, because what we've got here is something which, I have to say from my own point of view, my exposure to Metropolis as opposed to the iconic images that we got, and you could argue, well, isn't C-3PO in Star Wars heavily influenced by the shape of Maria? Just to address
absolutely, yes, as is Spaceballs the movie and
precisely.
Joan Riversbottom.
But of course, the notion of that emerged from the... Giorgio Moroder cut of Metropolis, which of course was at the height of disco fever and such like in the 80s, which led to Freddie Mercury and so on. As a purist, Dean, I'm not sure where you're going to go with this, but would you? I mean, we're obviously, for this series, we are screening not that version, okay? So we're screening the original version as best as our uncut version as we can get from that point of view. But from the point of view, I think some of the music's quite good, actually, but, you know...
But again, I was dismayed. I mean, sepia-toned all the black and white footage to like a blue or a brown.
Colorization was, I think, the buzzword, even the show.
It was like a pre-colorization in that it was a single tone over the whole black and white thing, which to me was a travesty, being already a fan of black and white film. Mm. But I had not seen this. My actual initial exposure to Metropolis was, unfortunately, that 86.
We share that bonding then, clearly. Love kills, and so does Giorgio Moroder, in every sense of the word. Here she comes with Bonnie Tyler. Genius.
I know. It had neat elements to it, but as a fan of silent film, I knew he had doctored something I wasn't pleased with. So it actually led me to go and keep in touch and follow along as they went and found other prints and other negatives around the world and started reassembling this back to its original form.
And yet there are still a couple of scenes that remain elusive, we hear. Even that Buenos Aires 16mm negative copy discovered in 2008, so in the 21st uh-huh. century, historians have spent over 80 years reinventing Metropolis. But it's generally regarded that what we've got now is probably as close to the original as you're ever going to get, really.
Absolutely. And they have some stills, production stills, that they put in with title cards explaining what this scene was about or what that scene was about in some of the restorations that I've seen. And I think that it's going to be now pretty hard to find anyone who's collecting silent film stock, because a lot of that was on nitrate film stock, which is highly volatile and degrades really quickly in oxygen.
It quite literally explodes.
It does.
Different line entirely. Let's consider the plot and the narrative from that point of view, because, again, there is a concept that says, well, didn't H.G. Wells also talk about Morlocks and Eli and an upper class who effectively were the privileged folk, although admittedly they ended up being fodder for the Morlocks, and the underclass effectively who would be enslaved and would toil thanklessly in the gothic bowels of the city. Is this really an artistic response to the likes of Fordism, as well as sort of communism, that mass production line, you can have any color you want as long as it's black, all of those sort of issues that are actually there?
I think so. You know, it sort of really was the beginning of a dramatization of the proletariat against the bourgeoisie, and that
It's only 9 years after the Russian Revolution, of course, so very much.
Absolutely, yeah. And so all of those ideas percolating and, anti-Bolshevik ideas ran fervent through Germany in the 20s and all that. So this movie, I think, showed a lot, but I think it's also, an expression of what he saw in New York City. Because if you went down into the subway system and saw people marching down. I don't know if you've ever been in rush hour in New York City in the subway system, but it's very much like the shift change at Metropolis, where the elevators open and you march in lockstep, shoulder to shoulder, trying to get to your next destination. It for me, resonated so deeply when I saw that, and hadn't been in New York only a couple of years previous to see that kind of massive humanity downtrodden and going through the undergrounds of the city was quite remarkable.
Almost as a science fiction as prediction, which, of course, as we've said, it doesn't really work as prediction. You've got to kind of look at the cultural systems that are happening when the thing is metamorphosing into the sign as well.
Right.
Clearly, it's set in the fictional world 2026. You've already alluded to the fact that we kind of are working through that process. But as, again, we sort of said, we're celebrating the year where we should all be having hoverboards and such like in Back to the Future. That hasn't quite taken place. Nor, indeed, has Blade Runner in certain instances, although that's another side of things there. Let's consider the performers and the actors, because I often feel within silent movie, we talk about the directors and the vision of the directors and obviously the work within that. What did you make of people like Rudolf Kleinroger as Rotfang? Because, I mean, in many ways, Rotfang is the prototypal or prototypical mad scientist. I mean, we could say, well, Frankenstein sort of before then, but Rotfang, the kind of glee and the demonic sort of look in his eye, you've got echoes there of obviously Faust and Mephistopheles, all of those kind of characters really coming to the fore here.
Right, and it's very much, again, of the pre-method acting Stanislav before he came out in 1922, that acting before of the French Lecoq training, of the physicality.
It certainly is not Brechtian distanciation, is it? We're engaging in that sort of side of things, really.
Yeah, it had more of a background to almost a commedia dell'arte thing of your key expressions. And think about even the final scene with the revolution and the flooding and all the children and how John has to sit in the single pose of angst for what seems like a good 7 minutes, which any actor would go, well, no, my motion would change. But he sits in that one freeze frame as action goes on around him. And this can only be done through an acting style that I was kind of trained in, which is a certain level of plastiques and external physicality that then you find your way into your emotional core. And it's a rarer method, but it was very common in Europe pre-method acting. And I'm using air quotes around method acting there.
I love your line that you've used frequently on Chilpack Hollywood episodes about how culture kind of is a snake that eats itself and then kind of eats its own, etc. We won't go down the full line on that particular aspect.
Yeah.
But if I mentioned the name Channing Pollock to your good self, who was obviously the soul who rewrote the version of Metropolis, which was released in the United States and removed all references to Frida's mother, and also took out Fredison's henchman, and also a hefty amount of the last act. Why? Yeah. Why? I mean, was it just a case of they felt at the time within Hollywood that actually the public couldn't sit through this kind of length of movie? They had to sort of trim it down? Or was it a case of, no, we've got to adapt, we've got to change these things around? Any sort of thoughts to why that was the case?
I think there was also this sense of divergent plot lines. Like, it seems that the assembled now, we can follow that plot. But if you look at early silent films, and particularly coming out of short films, two reelers that Chaplin and Buster Keaton, and those, you know, we had a very simple single character plot line that was an arc of, you know, boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl, that kind of thing where you're putting different complications in. And, you know, think of the mad scientist girlfriend whose name is Hell. Like that would have that would have been a swear word technically, so they had to remove that. So I think, you start trimming a bit, then you start trimming everything. You know?
I mean, isn't this also pre-Hays Code though? I mean, the Hays Code didn't actually come in until the 1930s or so. I mean, I thought they were allowed to get. I mean, I could understand it if they were doing a cut for TV, but TV wasn't around either in that sort of area. So it just seemed a bizarre decision.
But also realize that the Hays Code was percolating at this time. So there was already suspicion of European films that got away with nudity and more risque storylines. And so often there were people in Hollywood that when importing foreign films would be super sensitive because they didn't want the Hays Code to come in and stifle creativity throughout Hollywood. So they would be more adherence to morals when editing foreign films that were coming in.
It's a bit like being approved by the Comics Code Authority, which came in as a result of Frederick Vertum's Seduction of the Innocent, but that's another tale for another story. I love the sort of final concept of the movie. I mean, you could take it as an allegorical line, you could actually say it's just a message that's actually there, but the mediator between brain and hand must be the heart. It's that kind of suggestion, which, you know, it's not particularly revolutionary. You might almost say it's common sense as part of the human condition. But you know, is that something which, in terms of the movie Metropolis itself, it's looking to outline and work through and actually say, fundamentally, you need to cooperate and possibly collaborate rather than actually always act in opposition?
Absolutely. I think if you show a separation, which ultimately this is a metaphor of your heart and your head, and one that you stifle underground and the other that is allowed to flourish, that eventually one will be so repressed that it will stop, and ultimately all the functioning, power, water, all of these supplies will leave you. So you have to have a balance of mind, body, spirit, as it were, to have it all come together in order to keep flourishing forward. I think it's a great metaphor, and one that stands today, and a long way to get there for sure, but I think it pays off really well.
Just looking at some of the actual statistics here, 25,000 extras were actually used during the filming of Metropolis, obviously before CGI then.
Oh, man, and if you look at the flooding scene, those are all real little kids in massive amount of water coming in, and like it seems they're high-pressure hoses sprayed on these kids. You not only would CGI, you would never get away with that in terms of health and safety.
Well,
on set.
I did think you might have one or two issues with various, not just unions, but sort of a whole variety of other bits and pieces. It's also interesting, we talked about the proto-fascism and the whole thing, that it's also been suggested that the rich man's athletics competition actually foreshadowed the 1936 Berlin Olympic Games.
I thought that too, you know, in the Leslie Rosenthal camera framing of it all in terms of the dynamic lighting and each one being the Nietzsche Superman model as they ran. It had a lot of those elements, and I think also that goes back then to Carl Freund and his cinematography and that work going on, that this Metropolis having these sort of monuments, and that man himself is a monument, and the way that it's all heroically lit really went to then, you know, the way Liesl did Triumph of the Will and all of those rallies and the Olympics as well, you know, having that kind of cinematography, you could see a direct influence for sure.
Yes, great visions, pity about the outcomes, but never mind, that's entirely. I mean, let's consider the actress Brigitte Helm as indeed the android Maria and the character from that point of view. Clearly, you're in a sort of acting art where the cinematic arts have been with us when Metropolis is released for about 10, 15 years. There is a sense of where things are actually going. How much, I mean, and we're speculating here, but how much do you think sort of Lang's kind of input as a director would have kind of influenced the actors? Would they have taken total direction from the actors? I mean, because obviously there are lots of different kinds of directors. There are directors who will treat actors like cattle. There are directors who will engage the actor. They will enthuse. They will drive. What sort of sense do you get of Lang's sort of interaction with his cast?
Well, it seemed more, it was a very much... when you're working again in this training, this physicality, you are almost a choreographer. And if you look at the way the workers are underneath the ground, that is clearly a vision of a choreographer more than a director. You know, he's seeing the whole frame and he's telling the actors move in these positions. And so with Brigitte, who was, I understand, 18 at the time, she wouldn't have had a lot of experience. Mm. She would have been probably directed almost to the point of not line readings, but, you know, physicality, like look this way, stand this way, put your hands here, do that,
That's even younger than Gillian Anderson was when she actually sort of launched in The X-Files. Astounding.
I know. Think of that.
Certainly the other sort of aspect, which we haven't alluded to, but I suspect Shuster and Siegel might have had some sort of notion of Metropolis in their mind when they created that young man from Krypton, Superman, in 1938. I suspect they might have actually encountered the movie from the zeitgeist of the time.
I would think so. You know, think of that whole idea of again, I go back to Nietzsche, of the whole man as Superman, that you have this ideal that you're trying to achieve. Mm. And the film itself trying to achieve an ideal in terms of visualization. And I think Fritz Lang, this is a lot of how he worked, that he had a movie in his head and he saw it instantly in 1924 and then worked so hard to achieve that in the process, bankrupting the studio, as you said, and going way over budget.
Lots of sort of influences, as we mentioned. I mean, you can look upon the way science fiction has worked within this whole notion of vertical urbanity ever since. I mean, things like Stand on Zanzibar, the Harry Harrison Make Room novel, High Rise, Dark City, Neuromancer. We mentioned Blade Runner. All of this sort of notion that you sort of build high and build low and you work through that. Are we also talking about allegorical things or metaphors such as surface depths and other things? We talked about the structure of the film, certainly in terms of the movement. If sound had been employed at this particular stage, the movement would have been drastically restricted because it took a wee while before the technology of hiding microphones. I mean, presumably the microphone would have been hidden in the robot or something. Sort of work through that. So of its time, do you think it was basically the pinnacle of where silent movie was going to go? I mean, you know, because obviously sound began to come in 3-4 years after this in terms of the whole side of things and so on.
Well, The Jazz Singer actually came out the exact same year. I would think that had sound been in place, I think Fritz Lang probably would have recorded the industrial sound and then had the actors overdub their lines based to their, like he would have had them what we call now ADR, and that would have been very complicated, and even adding more to an artificiality that was there already in place. So I think we should be glad that it is silent.
Absolutely. Well, although, having said that, it's a bit of a misnomer to refer to silent movies as silent, because there would inevitably have been an accompaniment, orchestral or otherwise, whilst actually being viewed. So probably the first... major use, or one of the major uses, of the importance of background sound and images within the sort of thing. Because, you know, whether you were playing it on an organ, or whether you had a full orchestra side of things, from that point of view, it clearly was tapping into that whole notion of impact. And do you feel that actually the music will highlight particular areas? Does it, because clearly bad musical cues become so much of a cue that you kind of telegraph what's happening.
But in terms absolutely.
Of if they're done well, do you feel, again, the input for music, is that an intrinsic part of what we appreciate from the movie itself?
I think so. And even if you watch it with the sound off, there's still a rhythm to it, and the way the mass crowd scenes and a lot of it in terms of editing stuff has a rhythm that is very easy to hear even without music or other sound playing. So, for instance, when you see the workers before the massive explosion, not to spoil it for anyone, but they're clearly, Fritz Lang is doing counts. He's counting 5, 6, 7, 8, and everybody has to hit a position on the count. So I think because it seems to be the way he directed it, again, as a choreographer for those crowd scenes, and the way they're marching out of the elevators and then, you know, various things, you can see that he was giving them a count that would then be very easy for any composer to recompose and keep it to that rhythm.
Dean, we're actually working through in the background there Blood from a Stone with Cycle 5 from the actual 1986 version of Metropolis. So, well, I don't know if you can actually hear this, but I just thought it was quite a nice little sort of line to just take. We take a momentary break, a brief break. We'll come back to you if you'd stay with us to talk a little bit more about the movie, and also perhaps its personal influences with yourself and impacting from there.
Okay.
Very tempted to actually dedicate Blood from a Stone to Australian telephony companies, but perhaps we won't do that. Sometimes it's easier to get that Blood from a Stone. Never mind. We're here,
yes,
we're connecting,
okay.
It's working. That's the important thing. Praise
absolutely.
The Lord and so on. And for purists, we will be actually wrapping up the piece with the Berlin Radio Symphony Orchestra and their version of Metropolis from the opening scenario for the March of the Machines. So we will have
right.
that.
This did make me miss 80s music, though, I must say.
Well, there you have it. Exactly.
Sort of absolutely.
How excited were you when you realised that new footage had actually been discovered? Because we know Doctor Who fans, we love them, we appreciate them, etc. But the excitement, the tangible excitement over, oh, we've discovered a missing episode or one that was sort of missing, believed, wiped, and right. taken from that point of view. And in the same way with Metropolis, obviously there was a sense of loss that people would never see the full version because clearly who would have thought it would have ended up in Buenos Aires, possibly taken over via various other German folk post-war, maybe, or maybe not. But from your own sort of aspect, was it something which kind of appealed and you thought, oh, you know, this is good? How were you keen? Or did you have also a feeling of, potential disappointment, but you know sometimes you build something up, the sense of anticipation is more than the actual greater reveal? How did you find it when it sort of finally emerged?
Well, you know, when I was at Fox working on the X-Files, I became very good friends with the librarian in the archives, and he was a younger man, but he was not. But he had been there his whole life, and he, his predecessor, had taken a silent film footage and kept it in his basement of all things. And when he died, his family found all of this rare footage from Fox Films, including Chaplin outtakes and all of these things that they could then put back in. And when he told me that story, that got me into the whole idea of film preservation and restoration, and this idea that, you know, they sent out film prints around the world, and various projectionists would also have their ability to emplace their own morality and cut out scenes that they thought their community wouldn't like, and would keep those as well. So there is still potentially film out there, prints of film that could be still yet discovered. And again, as you say, you know, some of them may be just one for timing, one for a scene that doesn't make sense, or even where the film tears and they just cut that out and just kept it at their house. So yeah, every time you hear there's lost footage, it is a question that it could be disappointing because A, it may have been removed because it did not fit the film, or B, it was of, you know, some arbitrary nature and so short that it doesn't really amount to anything.
Of course, there have been various incarnations of the film, as we said, including Japanese manga approaches to Metropolis and so on. I'll sort of just throw one at you. After the tremendous success that the new series of X-Files will actually be, and it's going to and the commitment to that, let's say hypothetically, Chris Carter comes to you and says, "Dean, I'd like to remake Metropolis."
Wow.
What's your reason? I mean, I'm putting it out there as a sort of possibility. Yeah. You know, what would your thoughts be? Would you say, yeah, absolutely, let's go with it? And who would you consider, you know, casting? I mean, I suspect yourself as Rotvang, possibly, but that's...
Possibly, yeah, okay.
Well, just,
I could
know.
Do that one, yeah. I would be the mad scientist.
Yeah. How would you... Would you sort of say yes, or would you say no, we can't remake it? Needs to stay untouched.
Kind of, I am a purist that way, to stay untouched. But I would say if we want to revisit the themes, the ideas of the hearts and needs to mediate the hand and the body, then the idea of a working class in a subterranean world and a future of the sons of man and the clubs of sons and all that sort of thing, I would be interested in seeing a movie with that approach and that kind of visualization of what, you know, not 20 but 2126 would look like at the current rate. I think that would be an interesting approach, but to do a, you know, shot for shot, frame by frame remake of it, I would sort of say thanks but no thanks.
So you presumably argue for Metropolis 2.0 or Metropolis 3.1 or something along those sort of lines.
Variation.
Yeah.
The next variation, absolutely.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit more about the hero and heroine. Frieda, of course, or Freda, Gustav Fröhlich's character. He kind of is very much the eponymous hero. He falls in love with Maria, portrayed very much as a saintly revolutionary leader, secretly educating the workers. Do you think a touch of Joan of Arc coming across there as well?
Oh, for sure. And if you've seen that French Joan of Arc, a classic silent film, which is taken from the transcripts of Joan of Arc, a lot of the camera angles and the expressions and the way she is often looking skyward, heavenward, as it were, seems to be a direct result of the influence of that movie. Mm. I would think that, you know, as a relationship, it's kind of odd. I mean, a love at first sight, and how odd is it that they meet when she's allowed to take the children from the underground mm. on a field trip to see all the elite having their Olympic day running. I would think, well, that's kind of odd. Isn't that a really bad field trip to take kids to realize that there's a whole other world above them? Well, but that's indeed how they meet.
Yeah, I suppose you could say duty of care, but also that whole notion of saying, well, there we are. That's the world that you never have.
Exactly. Sure. It's like, well, why show me that? That's ridiculous.
Although, if you want to take another step back, you could say, doesn't Hollywood and the Dream Factory do that all the time? Show people worlds they can never have in certain instances?
See, yeah. I guess that's the case. But in the eternal hope of the American dream, it is theoretically available
to
anyone.
Of course, exactly. And that's why we could well be saluting President Kanye West. I don't know. It's enough to make you go to Australia, but still, never mind.
So true.
Different line. You can take that up with Bill on another Chill Pack Hollywood episode. So I'm sure that
perhaps I think I will.
Yeah, exactly. Dean, I can't believe the time just literally shot by in this sort of companion podcast. Obviously, people can listen to this before they see the movie or afterward, or even if they want to during it, if they wish.
Exactly.
They can sort of get a line from that. But if we were to ask you to encapsulate your own thoughts about Metropolis, which we have done obviously so far on the piece today, to sum up, what are the key areas that kind of continually resonate and will continue to resonate throughout the 21st century?
Well, let me tell you first off, my very personal connection to this was when I saw that 86 version. I was taking a multidisciplinary arts degree at the University of Simon Fraser in Vancouver, Canada. And so I was taking also contemporary dance. And one of the pieces I did was the actual choreography of Frieder when he takes over the job of pointing two arrows to light bulbs that light up.
Right.
So I had memorized that work and choreographed it right up till the explosion and then had other dance go on. But it was this idea of work and the crushing in mindlessness of what that job entails. And
crushed by the wheels of industry, as Heaven 17 would have said.
Crushed by the wheels of industry, absolutely. That a job now would be simply taken over by a robot, ironically. So that personal connection, when doing that physical choreography, was actually quite grueling. I know the way Gustav Frolik does it, seems like he's quite well in shape, and then he sort of has a collapse. But if you were to actually do that, and if it's Fritz Lang directing, there would have been multiple takes of that. It is much more difficult to do than it actually appears on film.
Yeah. I mean, again, you know, interesting from the personal point of view there. We haven't actually spoken about the machine room transforming into the ravenous sphinx, which, again, is just writ large with visual metaphor and imagery. I thought we most sort of work through that. The burning Maria revealing herself as the beautiful machine mensch or machine human from that point of view. We talked about the seven deadly sins. But there are so many classic visual moments here where you think, yes, that's really, it's worth the price of the admission ticket alone, really.
It really was. And it's this idea of, again, the triumph of art direction over plot, which one would say is also Blade Runner. I mean, Ridley Scott came from an art directing background. Blade Runner, you know, now seems more. But when it first came out, it was panned by the critics and was not a success at all, other than that visualization that then reverberated through science fiction films for the next 20 years.
And I think Blade Runner certainly will be coming up probably in the next series that we'll actually be doing. And clearly we'll be discussing about that. Plus, of course, the classic argument about the director's cut versus the original screen cut with the voiceover. And, of course, the green fields, which is wonderful where they go off into the green fields together. And she didn't know how long she had to live. Then again, who does?
Right, exactly. If you look at this, I mean, apparently Fritz Lang said in an interview that there was another edit that he would have done upon looking at it now. So when you say a director's cut of Blade Runner, that, you know, no film ever sits isolated from the context of the society that it came from. So often I know I talk to directors who look at old films and they go, yeah, were it to come out today, I would do this, or I would take this approach to it. And so if you look at Metropolis and how it is very much in context and a reflection of the time of 1927, that it now, some of it seems silly, of course, but it has the ability to almost come back and resonate more now than it may have had with American audiences in the 1920s.
And that time thing ties in, of course, with Phil Leonis and the views with respect to Logan's Run. Logan's Run, very much of its time in the 70s. Yeah. Here we have something again of its time in the 20s. Astoundingly, of course, we're now sort of further into the future than the movie Logan's Run was ahead of the original Metropolis, really. It's quite astounding, really, that time thing.
It's sort of bizarre. And how it predicts technology.
As long as Lang could actually turn around and say there will still be a weekly edition of Chilpack Hollywood Hour going live across the globe from the whole thing, that's what we need to look for. So shameless
right.
plug from that perspective. And of course we've got the
Thank
Lady
you.
Killers, which I'm sure in about 50 or 60 years ago you'll probably have an academic and an actor talking about the Lady Killers. What did Phil Leonis have in mind with respect to that? What was the motivation of Dean Hackland in the line from that perspective? Work our way through that.
I'm sure that will be a whole university course unto itself.
Well, thank you. Dean, it's been absolutely fantastic touching base with yourself. We are going out with the Berlin Radio Symphony Orchestra and Metropolis.
Excellent.
Now we managed to get this thing working. Hopefully you'll be back with us on Skype, maybe for one of our other sort of shows in the not too distant future, if we can coordinate on that thing, which would be splendid. So
I would love that.
Keep on keeping on. And, of course, a reminder, the X-Files released in the new year with, of course, the return of the lone gunman, Lang Leon. Hey, yay! So great stuff there. Plus, he's other things. Actually, a couple of shameless plugs for your own graphic narratives. People still available or things still available to download and access and so on. And how are the Dobermen?
Yeah, the Dobermans are fantastic. They're loving Australia. All of my graphic work you'll be able to get really soon on deanhagland.com. So easy. And I'll be announcing that on my Twitter feed, which is at D Hagland. So you don't have to spell out the whole thing.
Genius.
Yeah, go.